Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. She is Kaylin Kaler. We have Super Bowl participants. We have two teams that are going to play in the game now. We know who it is. The conference title games, maybe a little bit anticlimactic, not quite the crazy upsets or the drama of last weekend, but still really interesting games. And boy, I don't know. There's something nice to having like the two best teams go to the Super Bowl.
I agree. This is for the best. This is what the country needed. we needed to see, you know, the class of each conference in this game. This is a matchup you can feel good about. Like, if the Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes had not made the Super Bowl, as fun as it would have been to see Ryan Tannehill avenge his Miami career, we would have felt a little, something would have been lost. There would have been a hole in our collective football hearts for the Chiefs. So this is for the best. We couldn't have the Ravens. We have the Chiefs. It's for the best.
Legitimate. I think the Chiefs and the Ravens were 1-1A in the AFC.
Yes.
And I thought the 49ers all season were clearly the class,
yes,
of the NFC. And now that they're healthy, it's really no one's really touching them at this point. But we're gonna talk about the games. We're also gonna have the offseason look ahead for the two teams that were less than victorious this weekend. And we're gonna talk about the matchup just a little bit toward the end of the show. It'll be a good show. It'll be entertaining.
Super Bowl Miami. Get ready.
Let's get into it. You go to Mobile, Alabama first, and then Miami.
That's right. Right. Mobile is actually a better destination than Miami. You guys just don't know it. They're actually the home of they're the home of Mardi Gras, not New Orleans. It's Mobile.
It's a secret. You're not supposed to tell people that. Let's get into it. We'll start with the late game here, the NFC game. I mean, look, final score was 37-20. I almost feel like saying the game was not as close as the final score would indicate, just because it just seemed like it was over at halftime. Now, the 49ers defense was obviously great again in this one. They did break a couple times in the second half, which I don't know. When you're up 27 points at halftime, you can afford to do that. But really, the headliner for this game was this 49ers rushing attack that just, I mean, it's so creative. And you know, it's obviously Raheem Mostert with the, you know, he finishes with 29 for 220. Tevin Coleman had the elbow injury in this one that took him out, but Mostert gets 224 touchdowns. And this is kind of how this team was built, in that, I mean, look, these guys are so fast coming out of the backfield, and when they get through to the second or third level, it's kind of the same. It's almost the same. Obviously, it's a different execution, but it's kind of the same concept of like Lamar, when if you're back on your heels a little bit and you are just a little bit off balance one way or another, I mean, it's going to be a huge play.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way that they can do so many different things in their run game, and you just saw that in every play, because they just can do so many different things out of that looks the same to start with and ends up being totally different. And I think it, like, they were able to really take advantage of a Green Bay defense that was really not great against a run. I think they just spent so many resources on focusing on the pass rush and bolstering the pass rush, which had been missing for several years in Green Bay. And the ironic thing is they finally got that pass rush up to speed. And then in this game, the 49ers hardly have to pass at all, because they can just rely on the run game to do everything for them. So I think they were able to really exploit a weakness within the Packers defense in this matchup.
Yeah, Jimmy Garoppolo out there looking like Kirk Cousins with the nine dropbacks. Yeah, nine dropbacks and six pass completions in this one. And,
right.
And I mean, look, if your quarterback only has to drop back nine times in the game, that probably means things went pretty well, and you were probably protecting a pretty significant lead at that point. But, I mean, look, obviously the run game is just beautifully designed, and the misdirection stuff is working. It's just, it's like everyone involved in it can be a ball carrier or a blocker on any given play. You saw Debo Samuel had a couple of carries, one for 32, one went for 11, and then he was out there as like a lead blocker, you know, clearing out Darnell Savage, the free safety on one of Mostert's touchdown runs. It's, you know, Kyle Juszczyk. I mean, it's it's this sort of positionless football thing coming to life here, and you saw it in full in the run game. And look, like, George Kittle didn't have a catch in this game until, like, late in the fourth quarter.
When
it was, like, already decided. And he made the catch and was like, oh, right, George Kittle's on this team.
Yeah, and that was, like, so funny to me because we spent so much of this week, or, I mean, I didn't really spend any energy on this, but I saw a bunch of headlines like, George Kittle's not practicing. What does this mean for the 49ers? And, I mean, he ended up playing and he was fine, and they were just, like, resting him so that he would be fine for this game. But you know, he was much more valuable as a blocker in this game than he was as, you know, actually a pass catcher.
Yeah. I mean, sheesh. They just look, the design runs ended up going 38 for 286. That's about 7.5 yards per carry on this one. And then obviously the four touchdowns. And I mean, Mostert's just out there. He obliterates these pursuit angles once he gets to the second and third level. And, I mean, it's safe to say that the Packers defense had a great year, but they lack athleticism at the linebacker position, and I think even more than that, they were just not ready for this.
No, and last week was really interesting after they played Seattle. You know, I mean, you can tell in games when defenses get tired and when they're out on the field for a long time and it's really wearing them down, but I feel like it's more rare that you actually hear the players talk about that after the game.
Yeah.
And last week after playing Russell Wilson, who, you know, is running all over the place, and they did have a hard time with him as well. Like, they were constantly chasing him and, you know, rarely able to actually get a hold of him last week against Seattle. And after the game, I heard several of the players just say out loud, like, oh my God, I'm so gassed. Like, that was a lot, you know, and talking about lacking speed in the middle at that linebacker position. I mean, I think this was another game where if you were in that locker room after the game today, like, they would all probably be like, holy shit, like, I am totally everything, all of my energy is used up, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of both of these teams that lost today. They were both out there for a ton of plays last week. The Titans obviously had the extra day of rest, so maybe they don't have as much as a complaint here. But yeah, it was just Mike Pettine did such a good job with this unit, and it's such a bummer to see it go down this way in the final game, because it's such a bitter way for the season to end. You know, they had their issues on offense this year, but the defense overachieved, and I mean, wow, this was they were just overwhelmed in this game. One thing I did want to mention, and look, the 49ers defense continues to be the 49ers defense. You know, everyone had some fun. I know Darrell Revis I bet he had some of these tweets saved in draft for a long time. And when Richard Sherman finally got beaten deep over the top,
God,
he got to roll it out. I mean, look, Devontae Adams got behind Richard Sherman, and Aaron Rodgers made just a spectacular throw. A little bit of a reminder. We'll talk about that Packers offense coming up, but a little bit of a reminder that Aaron Rodgers really hasn't fallen off physically at all.
Right.
But yeah, Revis just out there, you know, not a man-to-man corner, as you can see. And it's always just been, I mean, look, Revis was a different specimen. I mean, Revis was on another level than anyone I've seen in the last, like, decade or so. But
right.
Richard Sherman is primarily a cover three corner, and he's really good as a cover three corner, and to ask him to be a man corner doesn't make any more sense than asking a man corner to be a sort of zone based corner, because it's not what they do. If you ask Patrick Peterson to play the style that Richard Sherman played, he'd probably be pretty bad.
Right.
Like, it's the whole point is it fits his skill set, and that's why they do it.
It's nice to hear from an actual critic of Richard Sherman that we can put a face to, because
yes.
I mean, honestly, like, I feel like I'm so, like, I love Richard Sherman, big fan. I have no criticism of him except for the fact that, like, he is always mentioning, like, oh, they're hating on me, everybody, like, they're hating on our team. And I just want to be like, who is it? Like, name some names. Give me some names. Give me some phone numbers, you know, like, who are these people? Because they're always these, like, faceless critics. And I get, like, you get your fuel from that. Like, that is how, you know, you find your energy and your inspiration. That's fine. But it just seems like, okay, nobody's actually criticizing you anymore. So this is good. Now we know there is a vocal public critic out there.
Yes. Yeah. It, to me, it's the equivalent these days of like, you can go out and find people who criticize you. It's like,
right.
Remember how movie trailers, when they do like the critics quotes for the trailers, you used to actually have to find like a critic who said something nice about your movie. But now if your movie's terrible, you can still just comb through Twitter and find like just some random Twitter user who's like, it's like, it was a nonstop thrill ride. Like, right. I didn't feel that way about Baby Geniuses at all. So, one thing I did want to mention about the 49ers secondary, which is mildly interesting in what was, again, a typically very good performance, I wasn't shocked by it, but they did not start Akello Witherspoon at the right corner spot. You had Emmanuel Mosley, and I was kind of wondering, like, and obviously, you know, Mosley is getting help over there against Davante Adams, and the Packers are very aware that Richard Sherman is not going to come to the right side to cover Adams if Adams is lined up there. But look, Mosley was sort of a pleasant surprise all season. You know, he's an undrafted guy. He had filled in for a while when Witherspoon was injured early in the year, but he was really good in this one. And he ended up having the interception as well. And you can kind of see, and again, not to get into a debate with Darrell Revis, who will never hear any of the words I say right now, but when you do this sort of cover three, corners don't travel with guys, they can focus on their technique on their side of the field. They get more consistent and clear views of the field playing that side of the field. A lot of guys will tell you they don't like switching sides of the field because it is, you know, it's, you have to do everything backwards, and that's not an easy thing. Same thing with like right tackle, left tackle on the offensive line. A lot of cornerbacks will say it's similar. So when you keep those guys on each side of the line, you sort of get the best out of them. They can specialize playing that side of the field. You saw it from Mosley tonight, who continues to really be a pleasant surprise this season and delivered the interception.
Yeah, and one thing that I just thought of when you mentioned that that he was undrafted and he's only played in San Francisco. He was an undrafted free agent for them in 2018. Breer, our colleague Albert Breer, he does his annual sort of roster construction column where he looks at how is every conference championship team built, like what is made up of these rosters. And one thing that stood out to me is I believe it was the 49ers who had the most undrafted free agents on their roster. I think they had 8 guys, which is kind of a signal to me that like this is a team that is developing, you know, that undrafted talent maybe a little bit better than their competitors are. And I think that goes back to John Lynch and Kyle Shanahan being so connected and in tune with each other and, you know, drafting specifically for what Shanahan wants and needs for his team. So that kind of stood out to me as when you just look at how these teams were constructed, with the 49ers having the most undrafted free agents, such as Mosley.
Absolutely. I mean, look, it's coaching and it's getting the right guys for your scheme, and it's a unique scheme on both sides of the ball. As much as people want to just sort of throw in Robert Saleh's like Gus Bradley 2.0, he has a very complex defense on the back end, and he's coaching this up. He has guys, everyone's looking for their man corners. If you can load up on some cover three corners, you can get some good guys because they're not necessarily in demand league wide. But let's take a quick look ahead here with the Packers. We know where the 49ers are going next week. Let's see where the Packers are going next season. It's just like, oh boy, they won 13 games. They won 14 games if you include last week. It just didn't really feel like it. And part of it is the fact that their identity changed. They were an excellent defensive team all year. We were waiting for it to click offensively. It became clear around midseason. I mean, they had one monster game against the Raiders when the Raiders were just, I don't know what they were doing. They just blew coverage after coverage. And other than that, just the offense didn't even come close to looking like it was going to play at it. They're not going to be at their like 2014 level again, but I mean, it just looks like a really mediocre unit right now.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, last week was like a small bright spot, but it was still really disjointed. And it was still like Davante Adams is the only guy. And You wrote a little bit about Jay Sternberger today, which I thought was really interesting because he is their rookie tight end, third round pick last year. And he was on IR for the majority of this season. He was one of their two IR, return from IR designated players. And actually last week I noticed when I was at the game last week, Green Bay against Seattle, and last week he had a big catch, and he was on the field a lot as a blocker. Not a lot, but a lot more than he had been in the past. He doubled his snap count last week. This week I hadn't looked up what his snap count was today, but he was out there. He had a catch. He had a touchdown catch. So that is something I would keep an eye on heading into next year. I think Sternberger, Jimmy Graham, another disappointing year for him this season in Green Bay. He had a big game last week, but that was like probably his biggest game as a Packer, last week's game for Jimmy Graham. So I think heading into next season, Jay Sternberger is a guy to keep an eye on. I think Rodgers and him are going to develop something, hopefully, going into next season. He kind of intrigues me a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of what it always comes down to with Rodgers is, I don't want to draw like absolute definitive conclusions off of what the season was, but he never seemed comfortable in LaFleur's offense. He still seems much more comfortable in the sort of improvisational, do your own thing type of thing out there, play off schedule a little bit. He has Adams he can do that with. Maybe Sternberger's a guy who emerges. I mean, they have to get another receiver in there. Valdez-Scantling was he was a disappointment this year. Mm-hmm. Geronimo Allison, he's probably never going to be more than like a third or fourth receiver anyway. Right. But you bring in a young guy, and it's like, how long does it take the young guy to build up the chemistry with Aaron Rodgers? Rodgers, again, he has really not fallen off physically in any significant way, but you figure it's coming soon, probably. Not to mention that offensive line is aging. So it's a really weird spot that they're in right now, where it's almost like whoever they bring in, they kind of have to hit a home run on it. It has to be a guy who, can come in and contribute early.
Yeah,
and do it with Rodgers, who's a guy who, again, you look back at when it was Jordy Nelson, they kept on bringing back James Jones because James Jones had the chemistry with Rodgers. Mm-hmm. But you can't do that. You can bring back Jordy Nelson and James Jones right now, but physically they're not going to be good enough.
Yeah, it's a weird, they're in a weird spot because even I remember kind of questioning what Rodgers said last week when Davante Adams had an amazing game and was route running spectacularly. Rodgers said something like, I felt like I was on the level with him as I had been with Jordy Nelson. Like I had a rare level of trust. He said something along those lines, which is amazing and encouraging. But at the same time, it's like, okay, like you're not going to have that with, you're not going to have that. Like you can't, that can't be the way your offense, that can't be the only way your offense is going to work and find like real success. So I feel like he's almost like stuck in the past in a sense of like, it's almost like a relationship breakup where he's like comparing every receiver to Jordy Nelson or like someone of that stature is kind of what it felt like to me. And it's like, he needs to figure out like how to move on with younger guys who aren't going to be at that point right away. And maybe not for like 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
But it's a weird situation there.
It's such a big ask of him after all these years of doing it his way.
Yeah.
To sort of, I mean, I don't know, they'll have another offseason in it, and maybe he'll move a little bit more toward LaFleur's offense at this point. But I'll just say two more things before we move on to the early game, the AFC game. I was glad that in the second half they finally started putting Aaron Jones on the field in yes. obvious passing situation. That sort of look, there's somebody who said with Jamal Williams, there's somebody who said for the guy you can rely on, you know the spot he'll be in, you know he'll pick up the blitz, but considering what they have outside of Davante Adams and that offense, you need the second dynamic player on the field, and that is Jones.
That's Aaron Jones.
It's not Jamal Williams. So he got a little more playing time on the obvious passing situations in the second half. But the only other thing I wanted to mention was Jay Sternberger as a tallish white dude wearing number 87 just, it still throws me off. Every time like I see him like go in motion or something, like wait, did they re-sign Jordy Nelson? No, okay.
That's, oh no, it's right, not him.
That's Sternberger, okay.
Yeah. The one thing I will say about these Packers, which is not really like an on-the-field thing, but it's certainly a difference that I noticed actually like visibly this year. The keyword culture, which I hate, but also I don't know what else to say. I don't know what other word to use here. The vibes, I guess, like being around the team before LaFleur during the McCarthy era, there wasn't a ton of expression and like, you know, vocal. It just was a very quiet locker room. There wasn't like a lot going on. Like there wasn't a ton of personality from the players. And this season, with the new guys they brought in, like Billy Turner, the guard, offensive guard, super like hipster, like real like peace and love and very creative. He actually designed custom made sweatshirts and jackets for everybody on the team for Christmas. And there was like a patch with their last name on it. And then like this cool, like handprint sort of patchwork, like thing on the back. And it'd be one thing to like give those presents and then nobody wears them, right? Cause they're like, I don't like this shit.
Yep.
But everybody has been wearing them like all the time. And I thought that was just really cool. Like I never saw that before. Like you would go in the Packers locker room before and everybody's just wearing like Packers stuff. But now like people are wearing like Billy Turner's jackets that he made everybody with their number and their little last name patch on it. And it was like, it was just kind of cool to see that. And then Rodgers actually talked about that in his press conference last week about how this like LaFleur as their coach and like bringing in guys like Za'Darius Smith, who is a super loud, charismatic, vocal personality in that locker room now. Billy Turner, Preston Smith, just bringing in guys from other places where they hadn't necessarily made those splashes in free agency as much before. He really pointed that out as to something that like has changed the amount of like fun and like expression and like personality that they are able to be in that locker room now. So I thought that was kind of interesting as like a quote unquote culture change.
It is. I mean, look, it's a different team in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully they score more points next year. That would be very helpful.
Right. The culture needs to translate on to scoring.
Yes.
More scoring. That
would be good. Let's go to the AFC game here. The Chiefs once again just decide they're going to spot an opponent 10 points.
Yeah.
And you know, and then just kind of do whatever they want for a while. This is, I mean, look, they're down 10-0 in the first quarter, and obviously they're not out of it. But like the Titans didn't fall off. The Titans didn't make any like you know drastic mistakes in the first half. They played quite well in the first half, and it got to halftime, and it was not only 21-17 Chiefs at that point, but they were getting the second half kickoff, and it was just kind of like, man, this is really discouraging.
Yeah.
if you're a Titans fan.
Yeah, and the weird thing about this game was it almost started like almost exactly like the Houston game did, where the Chiefs, like Travis Kelce, drops a third down conversion, like a pass that would have converted a third down, and they go 3-and-out on their first possession, and you're like, oh, well, maybe the opponent, the Titans or the Texans, have a chance here. And you start believing in that opponent, and then you're like, ah, no, they don't. Like, there's no way. So, yeah, I think Vrabel got as much as he could out of this Titans team. Like, I think he wrung them out, you know, wrung out that towel, as much water as he could get out of it. Like, I couldn't see them really doing anything more in this game.
I mean, look, the Titans have a fascinating offseason coming up. This Chiefs team, though, and it's Patrick Mahomes, obviously all the highlight reel stuff. Everyone loves the highlight reel stuff. It's also, you know, Greg Bishop for us wrote about this a couple weeks ago. You know, he worked very hard on the routine stuff, and he was very good during his MVP season and just sort of the down to down. You know, if you took away the crazy second reaction stuff, he was still probably MVP in 2018 as well. But it's his decision making, and like, look, when he tucks the ball and runs, it's like it's always the right decision. And obviously, you know, he had the highlight reel run where I'm not really sure what was going on in the Titans secondary.
No clue what they were doing.
I don't know why they just like. It looked like they were pratfalling in like a you know, like it was a State Farm ad and you weren't supposed to like hurt him or whatever. But I mean, I don't know. When the Titans played the Ravens last Saturday night, there are things that if you can force Lamar Jackson, like if you can force Lamar to make a lot of throws outside the numbers, he's not comfortable with that. That is a weakness in his game. I am not sure if there is something anywhere near an equivalent with Patrick Mahomes. There's just, and you could go around the league and probably find a weakness with every quarterback. I don't know if he has a weakness right now.
Yeah, it's like, what is his Achilles heel? That would be a good story idea if you like ask, you know, defenses. But I don't think anyone would have an answer really. I don't know. And it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, where in order to beat the Chiefs, you almost have to rely on them making mistakes, dropping the ball, fumbling, things like that, where you could take advantage of that and then score points off of that mistake, or, you know, or like what the Titans did. I mean, and the Titans had a great strategy, like, and it still didn't work. Like, the Titans took up, I think, 9 minutes on one of their second touchdown drive. It was 15 plays, 9 minutes, 7 seconds. And that's a great strategy because you're keeping the ball out of Patrick Mahomes' hands. Like, the more that, like, you can possess the ball and keep it out of Mahomes, that's going to benefit you. But, I mean, it's just, I don't know. I don't know what his Achilles heel is.
I mean, they had the 2 touchdowns in the 4 minute span at the end of the first half here. And Mahomes, by the way, I mean, this was his 4th postseason start. He's yet to have a turnover. Obviously, the numbers are very gaudy across the board at this point. But the other big story from this one is look, the Chiefs did not really give up a whole lot in the way of big plays. A.J. Brown had a big catch and run early. They did late when they were, you know, protecting a 3-possession lead. They gave up a long fake punt. But other than that, there were just no big plays. Derrick Henry has been breaking off so many long runs. He didn't do it early this season. He did it a ton in the second half of the year and in the postseason. And it's not only, you know, they weren't just like 25-yard, right? He was breaking off like 60, 70-yard runs. His long run in this game was 13 yards. It was his first game in 8 games where he didn't have a 20-plus yard run. And, you know, 19 carries for 69 yards as the focal point of the offense, it's just it's not really going to work.
Yeah, and I think Spagnuolo did a really good job. And I remember they pointed out specifically, I'm not going to remember the exact situation right now, but he pointed out specifically he went to a goal line defense. And it was, they were not on the goal line. And that was just a really creative, and, you know, a risk to put that out there at the time, but it worked. And, you know, because they wanted to stop Henry. So I think they did a really good job with that. And, you know, I don't think this game sort of takes away from the impact that Henry has had this season and the insane postseason that he had. But, you know, I felt like it was something that was like bound to come to an end at some point. It didn't seem like really sustainable all the way to the Super Bowl. But I mean, it was incredible what they did with him. And it was funny. I remembered, I was like, didn't I write about Derrick Henry like 5 years ago? So I Googled the story I wrote. I think it was actually 4 years ago, technically. But it was right when he won the Heisman. And there was, I think people forget that there was like weird like criticism of him and like doubt of him because of the amount of carries that he'd had his junior mm-hmm. year at Alabama, because he had like almost 400 carries that season, and you know, and because he's so tall, his lower half, it's such a bigger target to tackle and bring down. Like, I'm reading the story and I'm like, this is such baloney, like I can't believe, you know, because the subhead was like, how will his skills translate to the NFL? Like, it was some huge question. So that was kind of entertaining looking back on that.
Well, that workload is kind of like it's what will make his offseason interesting here. And look, they can't afford to let him go. At the same time, I think a lot of teams would look at, like, you know, oh, Todd Gurley, or go back to, like, DeMarco Murray, and the guy's coming off sort of the large workloads, and do you want to pay them? I don't know if anyone else really has the appetite to come pay Derrick Henry. As I said, like, the Jaguars should come get him or something like that, and just make the Titans worse, and then you can have your Tom Coughlin dream 1-2 punch of Fournette and Derrick Henry. It's very unique how this offense was built. Arthur Smith, I thought Arthur Smith was winning the battle against Steve mm-hmm. Spagnuolo in the first half of this game. And not only that, I think it was setting up, when the Chiefs were given all those single high safety looks, it was really setting up the play action game for the second half. But because the Chiefs scored those touchdowns and sort of pulled away a little bit, I don't think Smith ever quite got a chance to sort of fully unveil what he would have had in store for the second half had this been like, the Titans protecting like a small lead.
Definitely. He was on a roll with his play calling in the first quarter there. That was really fun to see a big man touchdown with Dennis Kelly catching that touchdown pass. And, you know, he's like a backup offensive lineman, so that was awesome. And then there were a couple of those direct snap to Derrick Henry plays that both were successful. So they were doing some different stuff that was really fun and, you know, made me excited about where it was going. And I think you're right. I think once they fell behind, they couldn't really continue with what he'd set out to do.
Well, the Titans, it really is. I mean, they're going to retain Ryan Tannehill and they're going to retain Derrick Henry. I mean, I don't see any other scenario where they move on from those guys. My guess is they would franchise tag Tannehill and probably work out something with Henry that will amount to a very wealthy deal for running back, but probably like a 2-year deal with a third-year team option is what it will essentially amount to, because I mean, look, he crossed the 400 touch threshold. That makes people very nervous, and mm-hmm. But they can't completely change their identity. The two pending free agents that really interest me with the Titans, what's going to happen with them? One is Logan Ryan, who I think has just been a rock in that secondary. I think Malcolm Butler has been something of a disappointment, but Ryan has been really solid. I think he's right on that sort of like second tier of, he's a guy who can play inside a little bit. He can obviously play outside. I think he's a really nice piece in that secondary and very valuable for them. The other guy is Jack Conklin, the right tackle, who was terrible in 2018. And for that reason, they declined his fifth-year option. And then he sort of had it was a nice bounce-back season. And he was certainly one of the better right tackles in the NFL. He was, I mean, quite frankly, he wasn't really an all-pro performer as a rookie when he was named first-team all-pro. But he is a quality right tackle. I would be really surprised if they weren't willing to pay him. The problem is going to be, like, right tackle. I mean, look at what Trent Brown got. Look at what Nate Solder mm-hmm. got. Look at what a guy, you know, inside a guy, Andrew Norwell got. When these offensive linemen, this sort of second-tier, good, quality offensive linemen get on the open market, they just get paid huge. And sort of same thing with cornerbacks. Logan Ryan is 29 years old, so maybe that sort of cools his market a little bit. But I wouldn't be surprised if a team tried to come in and swoop either of those guys.
Yeah, I mean, you're totally right about the money for, kind of second tier lineman like that. I mean, it's huge. I think I just looked up Solder's. It was 4 years, $62 million. So with $35 million guaranteed. So it's just, yeah, I could definitely see that happening. And that's kind of concerning because so much of their offense depends on those five offensive linemen being in like total sync with the choreography there, with all of that, wide zone runs. Mm-hmm. So that's a little concerning because you don't really want to bring in a different guy. And it's not like you'd be starting over, but you'd have to catch that player up to speed. So that's a little bit concerning. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
All right. Well, we've reached that point of the show, Kaylin, where we're going to talk about this matchup ever so briefly. Super Bowl 54 in Miami, Chiefs 49ers, lots of red, on the field. I'm like thinking it through. I've been thinking through for a couple hours now, and I don't know who I like more. I think both of these teams are excellent. I think there are a few weaknesses. I'm fascinated to see what Patrick Mahomes does against this 49ers defense. That is really, mm-hmm. I mean, the 49ers have complexity on the back end, but it's also not a, you know, it's not a bells and whistles defense. It's not something to be solved. They're right. really good on the back end. They're excellent in the pass rush. Early in the season, when the Chiefs were banged up on the offensive line, Eric Fisher was out for a while. DuVernay Tardif was out for a while. And you know, also Mahomes is sort of battling an ankle injury, so that affected it too. But teams were able to get to Mahomes, and you kind of wonder, can the 49ers do that? Can the 49ers sort of throw this you know, sort of off rhythm a little bit?
And that's probably exactly what this game is going to hinge on. Because as we talked about earlier, like as we've seen in these last two playoff games, the Chiefs have just been unstoppable, even after giving up, you know, 10 points in this game. What was it, 24 points last week? So it's kind of like that's where this game hinges, I think, is if the 49ers can really generate a pass rush and have an effect on Mahomes in a way that the previous two defenses in the postseason have not had. And I think it's pretty fun that this is not a rematch of any sort. Like, we haven't yeah. seen these two teams play this season. Because, you know, I'm like, when is the last time they played? I looked it up. It was September 23rd, 2018 at Kansas City. Kansas City won 38-27. It was actually the game. It's only significant because it's the game where Jimmy Garoppolo tore his ACL. So,
oh, yeah.
So that's kind of a fun little fun fact for you guys. Obviously, that's not really relevant to this game, and reading into anything from that game is like completely insane, because that was almost, you know, that was almost, it feels like it was almost two seasons ago now, and these rosters are so different, and Nick Bosa is here, and the Chiefs now have a passable defense that is not like, you know, a thorn in the side of the offense. Like, it's a defense that can actually keep them in games as opposed to being a hindrance. So these two teams are so changed since then. So I think it's really fun that we just don't really, we don't have like a, oh, this is what happened in week six. We can't look to that and see any sort of precedent.
Yeah. To me, I think one of the most interesting storylines is last year, what we saw was, you know, you have the 2 weeks to prepare, and ended up being the defensive staff, the defensive staffs ended up getting the better of the offensive staffs.
Right. Right.
On each side. I mean, Wade Phillips' unit was better than Josh McDaniels. And then obviously what Brian Flores and Bill Belichick cooked up was better than what Sean McVay had. This year, I mean, Kyle Shanahan and Andy Reid with 2 weeks to prepare. I mean, that's like a nightmare scenario if you're a defensive coordinator. But yeah, we'll see. Salah's been great all year. Spagnuolo's obviously been really good all season. It just feels like it really could go in so many different directions, and that's probably the worst analysis ever given.
Analysis.
Either team
we
could
don't,
win.
We don't know. We don't know anything.
Do you have a gut feel right now?
I would say Chiefs, just because I think Mahomes, I think he's, as you wrote today, I think he's just invincible. I think unless they make some major mistakes, which is very possible, I think it's going to be the Chiefs. But I also think it could be a really close game. It's going to be a good battle.
Yeah. I think I'm leaning 49ers.
Really?
Slightly. Yeah.
Why?
71-70, 49ers. For the final score. I really do like the thought of Kyle Shanahan having the 2 weeks to sort of roll out.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't need to see it in this game on Sunday, because he, you know, they got out to the big lead, and certainly the run game was doing more than enough. But He just seems to always have two or three plays in his pocket in the run or in the passing game that, you get to a point where it's like, Garoppolo's not really doing anything. And all of a sudden, like, oh, here's a play where George Kittle's just running uncovered 40 yards downfield and there's a free touchdown. I feel like he has a couple of those left this year, that he can run out. And then on top of that, I do wonder if the pass rush will affect Mahomes enough. I mean, they're not gonna, it's not gonna be like last year where, either offense is shut down. But, you hold Mahomes to three touchdowns. The Chiefs only score 27 points instead of 47. And I think the 49ers might have enough offensively between, obviously, a very creative rushing attack. And I do just think there are a couple of shot plays left in Kyle Shanahan's pocket for him to roll out in this one. So just gut feeling right now is 49ers in like a one possession game.
Yeah. I mean, I would give Kyle Shanahan a coaching edge over a lot of like most NFL head coaches, but like maybe not Andy Reid. You know, I mean, these are two great coaches matching up against each other, which is another reason why it's so exciting. And that's why if I could go back and re-pick the 49ers to win today instead of the Packers and not roll with the underdog, I feel like, I should have done that because Kyle Shanahan is just a more experienced, more proven creative guy than we've seen from Matt LaFleur. And I think that was like part of the game today too, is that Shanahan is just really a much better coach at this point.
By the way, have you seen the opening betting line?
I have not. What is it?
MGM has one. Do you want to guess? This is an old game with Andy where I'd make a guess.
No, I don't.
Chiefs are 1-point favorites.
Whoa. So it's really tight.
There you go.
That's exactly how I feel.
Yeah, 53.5 for the total. So pretty good, like a 27-26 Chiefs victory if it goes the way Vegas expects.
Wow.
That always fluctuates greatly over the course of the 2 weeks, especially because there's no football next weekend. And so what are you going to do besides make stupid bets?
Exactly.
That's my plug for
the
gambling
podcast. Be safe out there, people. Be safe out there. Make good money decisions.
Well, we will on the podcast network here, MMQB Podcast Network, we'll have plenty of shows in the next 2 weeks dealing with Super Bowl, dealing with some of the coaching changes, some off-season look-aheads, some of the storylines we'll be talking about, and a little bit of draft stuff. We'll see what goes on. We got some folks down at Senior Bowl this week, but it's going to be a wrap for this one. The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is Kalen Kaler and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. And Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.